wellnesscoach.com. Streaming wellness into your life.
Welcome to Karen's Couch. Welcome. Thanks so much for tuning in to this week's episode where I bring you somebody who's a very, very special friend of mine. He's an amazing man. He's created this extraordinary life for himself. And I think that his diversity and the variety that he has in his life is going to be particularly interesting to everybody who's listening. And I think that one of the things that I really wanted to drill down on with today's guest, and it's Marcus Pierce. Now, for those of you guys who don't know who Marcus is, I'm going to tell you in a second. But one of the things that I really want to drill down on with Marcus, because for me, he's the epitome of this every time I look at him. Marcus has the ability to maneuver, and it's kind of like he's a lightweight in life. And it appears that way. So whether it really is that way, I don't know. But, you know, he's a lightweight. He's not this massive, heavy machine that can't pivot, change, maneuver, develop, create on the turn of a dime. He just, you know, from my experience of you, Marcus, it's been around, you know, there's nothing that you don't turn your hand to, and you turn your hand to it with the greatest of ease. It's almost as like life has you on a magic carpet ride. And when we look at you, you kind of float through life, and you do it with grace, but you do it without the fluff and the drama and the trauma that a lot of people go through when challenge or change or new decisions thrust upon you, or you create new opportunities that totally transform the direction that you're going in. And I really want to talk to you today about what that's like from a man's point of view who's got a family, because I know that there's extra pressures on men when it comes to being the provider. And I want to talk to you about what you do and how you do it so effortlessly, because nothing ever seems to get under your skin. Nothing ever seems to bother you. It's like I said, it's like life has you on this magic carpet ride. And I find that both perplexing and I find it fascinating. And I really think that there's something about you that the rest of us need to know about, because what's in you is in us. And I want to know how we can drag it out. So welcome to Karen's Couch, my friend.
This is going to be fun. I am going to make sure that I edit this interview and only play the introduction to myself over and over again, because there's a lot of mantras that I could bring in just from your introduction there. I've just written them down here. And I've written down a few faults just so I can make people – you've made me feel superhuman. I'm going to bring back the audience to make sure that they know that I do have faults, and there's certain things that I do not tolerate very well at all in life. But thank you so much for having me, Karen. I'm absolutely pumped for this interview. I know it's going to be fun.
Oh, look, you know, ever since I met you – so for everybody who doesn't know, Marcus is really the brainchild of the Wellness Couch. He's the producer, he's the creator, he's the man who pulls it all together. He's the one who's in charge of everything. And right now on the Wellness Couch, which is a massive global movement of podcasts, how many shows are on there that you're...
Oh, we're at 11. At this recording, we're at 11. By the time this goes to air, it could be 12, 13 or 14. There's definitely a lot of growth happening within the couch at the moment.
This is insane. And how many people do you think statistically follow the Wellness Couch and all of the podcasts collectively?
Well, before, at the start of the year, it was at about 1.25 million annual downloads. But with the new podcasts on, I'd be pretty confident in saying that's up at around 1.5. I have no doubt we'll be at 2 million downloads by the end of the year.
That's amazing.
Yeah, well, in Australia, that's awesome. You know, in America, you know, I've got to remember this. I'm constantly reminding myself, you know, there's podcasts in America that have, you know, 800,000 annual unique downloads a month, but they're 20 times the size of Australia. You know, and about volume and weight of population and the rest. But, you know, 3/4 of the listeners of the Wellness Couch are Australia, and about a quarter are international. And I think, you know, in Australia, it's a mighty achievement. It's a great achievement, not so much by the couch, but by the people of of Australia and the wider world to actually adopt the, you know, the podcast medium. I mean, you and I are biased. We love podcasting, but any new technology often takes a while to adapt to, and I think people are running to podcasts in droves, and so I'm just so grateful that so many people will find what we do valuable.
And I'm rapt that we're kind of at the beginning of it too, like we're at the inception of it, you know. It's kind of
that's
like,
exciting, isn't it? When you know that so few people are even know what a podcast is or even know how to access them, I think it definitely feels like we're on the ground floor and yeah, we started the lift.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's awesome. So you play a massive role in the Wellness Couch in terms of running the events, the Wellness Breakthrough, the retreats that we've got coming up. You also orchestrate the Wellness Summit once a year in Melbourne, which is massive.
Yeah.
You know, where all of the people who run podcasts share the stage, which is just, you know, it's life-changing for all of us who are the speakers. But also, I mean, those rooms are filled with, like, I think the last one was close to 1,000 people.
Oh, no, you're like Damien Christoph. He's like, let's get 5,000 people in the room.
Yeah, let's do it.
Well, the room holds 600. We may have squeezed 1,000 in, but no, we had about 600 in at Crown. If we go up to 1,000, then we lose the intimacy of the room. We lose that, the experience totally changes. So it's a sellout event. There's no doubt about that. But I kind of, you know, I still have an internal battle in my head. If we make it 1,000 or even 1,500, essentially, if we move over to the Melbourne Convention Centre, then it's a very different event. And I'm sure you and I have both been in events before where you do hit 1,000 plus, but it's a very different type of event. You're not making friends. You don't get to speak to the speakers. You don't get to run into them and, you know, go to their stalls and all of the rest. But I really like what we have at Crown in Melbourne. It works really well. And, yeah, it's one of those once-a-year events, which we all absolutely love being involved with, don't we?
Oh, I love it. I look so forward to it. So, Marcus, the reason that I wanted to get you on the show is because, you know, it has been said that men don't multitask well. But you are absolutely the exception to the rule. And, you know, I want everybody to know that, you know, towards the end of the show, we're going to really unwrap where Marcus is at right now. And it's so going to be worth waiting for. Talk to us about what makes you into you in the context of your ability to make decisions that have brought you to where you are right now, and how you've gone about the choices that you've made, because some of them have not been terribly popular and some of them you haven't had a great deal of support for.
Yeah.
But I think that's one of the biggest issues that we have as men and women, is that we can think we know what we want, but we can never really know until we're in it.
Yeah.
And when we don't get support around us, it makes it so much more challenging. And oftentimes we tend to attract people into our lives that are our opposites, either from a relationship point of view or from a business point of view. And they kind of challenge the way that we think. And on one hand, I always think, well, it kind of forces me to think to myself, how important really is this to me? Am I really willing to stand in the face of objection and still plow through it? Or am I willing to let it go because their view is better than mine or their view resonates more than me? So I kind of look at it that way, as opposed to resisting the fact that there are people who don't support me necessarily. I look at it as a way to cause me to choose one way or the other.
Okay, well, feel free to interrupt me as much as you want. Let's freestyle through this answer, because I'm taking notes as you talk, because there's so many different layers that I can go on here. But the first memory I have, first of all, you talk about multitasking, and I think, and this is a long answer to this, but the first memory I have of, I always wanted to be a journalist growing up, and the first memory that I have of that is growing up loving football. My dad took me to the football when I was 5. I think I got on TV on my first ever football game. I got mud on my face. The ball was kicked for a goal. It was a muddy day. I got mud on my face. And I remember there's a shot of me with a red jacket on, 2 white lines down my sleeves. It's funny the memories you have, isn't it? But I remember that, and I loved being at the football. And I knew that I just loved football so much. And I was just telling you about this before we went on air, but I loved writing down everything that I read in the paper. So back in those days, the mid-80s, newspapers were everything. And once a year, an annual football season guide would come out, and I would write down all of the stats out of the magazines. I'd write down the player's date of birth and where they were from and how many games they'd played, how many goals they'd kicked. And it was silly when you think about it. I was just writing down what was already in the books, but I absolutely loved it. And as I was saying, you know, even though it doesn't really make sense, the fact that I loved it was important. That was a very big clue as to what I loved to do. And so the next 10, 15 years of my life were just dedicated to wanting to become a journalist. So I went to school, did all of that. I was one of the lucky ones where I knew what I wanted to do straight out of school. There was no gap years. There was no ummings and ahhings. I knew exactly what I wanted to do. Got into journalism at RMIT, which back in those days, I don't know if it's that exclusive anymore, but back in those days, you sat this big exam called the Journalism Entrance Test, called the JET Test.
Wow.
Thousands of people would sit it. I think 40 people got in there. But it was a very exclusive. Back in those days, I think it was the only journalism course. And when I say back in those days, I'm talking the year 2000 was my first year of uni. But back in the year 2000, it was the only journalism course around. You've got to remember, there was online media was a minnow back then. I mean, in the year 2000, yes, the internet was around, but it wasn't a massive deal. It was just one of those things that we knew was coming. Not to sound boastful, arrogant, but I knew I'd get into the course. I just, you know, when you know that you know.
It's just instinctive. You just know it intuitively that that's for you. It's got your name all over it. Yeah. There's no doubt.
That's it. When I was accepted, you know, it wasn't like, oh my gosh, I got in. It was just like, okay, when do we start? Let's get to it. And I was a little bit industrious in that course. I didn't really like the course. I was lucky enough to it's funny how thin threads occur, which Malcolm Gladwell talks about in The Tipping Point, but my mum's boyfriend at the time, my parents were separated, my mum's boyfriend had a friend who was working at a sports radio station, the local horse racing station actually, and I got a week-long gig as an assistant producer there. No money, just get up at 4:30 in the morning, go and work for 5 hours, finish at, you know, 10:30 in the morning, and then go straight to uni. And I did that for a week, and then about 2 weeks later, I got a call saying, one of the producers has resigned. Would you like to come and join us as the assistant producer of The Breakfast Show? And I was like, you're beauty.
Shut the front door.
I was 19. I was on a wage of $500 a week. $5,000 a year at the age of 19, I think I was, getting up at 4:30 in the morning, so my social life was shut out the window. although I do remember one morning rocking up to work, having not been to sleep, having come straight from the nightclub straight to work.
Oh my goodness!
But they were the days.
Those were the days when you actually could.
No, exactly.
And then you could back it up and do it the next day, and the day after, and the day after, and the day after.
Exactly. But that's where the multitasking came in. This is where you ask about multitasking. I think, and I really, I mean, strictly, I am just like every other man. I really am a one thing at a time kind of guy. But what, you know, what you're referring to, Karen, is when you see me with my wellness couch hat on and we're doing live events and there's so many things happening, I think all of that comes from live radio, because there's nothing like live radio. It's so much more dynamic even than live TV. It's just faster, more stuff can happen. But live radio for me was really my path into really having that ability to be able to, I suppose, get many things done at once or be able to focus on it. So that was really, and I think that kind of, and at that time, still remember at 19 years of age, you're very impressionable. So I had some great mentors in the media at such a young age, but at the same time, you also take on people's traits much more when you're younger. And so I, you know, even to the point, you know, you realize when you hang around people, you start talking like them, you use the same words as them, but you also begin to adopt the same behaviors as them, sometimes the same worldviews. And that's sometimes a good or a bad thing, sometimes the same health practices, which can also be a good or a bad thing. But I remember at that time that, you know, I was a real sponge. I just wanted to learn. I had big dreams. I wanted to be the next Eddie Maguire or Bruce McAvaney. I knew kind of where I wanted to go, and I had great mentors. And I think that's where that, that multitasking came from. And then,
Can I just ask you, like, it sounds like right from the time that you were at school or young, like six, you had clarity on what you wanted to be when you grew up.
Oh yeah, I knew I was never going to play football. Like, I played it, but I was terrible. But like, to the point, I was commentating the football. I was commentating the football in year 12 because I just knew. I knew it was good for my showreel more than anything.
Really?
Like, I just knew that it was great to have. Like, here I am, I've commentated 12 games of football. Yes, it was school football, but it's a great experience to just commentate live events because, you know, these days, I mean, it's so rare to get live TV on. So to have to be commentating live events was just a great experience, even if it was just the school team, you know.
But you knew what you wanted to do. There was no question about it for you. There was no doubt in your mind. Did your parents support that you wanted to be a journalist? Were they excited about that for you?
Oh, I think so. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my mum loves radio. She's I grew up in Victoria. 3AW is the premier talkback radio station in Victoria, and I grew up on 3AW. I grew up on football, 3AW, and jazz music. So, you know, and lots of football on TV. You know, so even though, you know, our kids hardly watch any TV at all, but if that was me, I would probably not be doing what I'm doing now because my media exposure growing up was a massive part of my life purpose. So, you know, there's no mistakes. There are absolutely no mistakes. And even though I was probably addicted to watching TV and, you know, sometimes those addictions are very healthy in a cosmic woo-woo sense.
When you think about it, it was purposeful for you.
Oh, like, yeah, absolutely. I wasn't wasting time escaping the world. It was growth, you know.
That's fascinating because it kind of you know what my question around that then is, and I don't know that there's even an answer to this, but it's innate.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes you can't explain the things that happen in your life sometimes, can you? I mean, look at your story. You can't explain it a lot of the time. It just happens and it's innate.
And you weren't watching telly because it was mind-numbing cartoons. You were watching telly because it was media. It was preparing you for the rest of your life. Like, yep. And it was kind of as if you knew that.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, in my case, it was listening to the commentators and hearing the inflection in their voice and the way they spoke about things at different times. And as I got older, I'd start to critique it. You know, I'd be like, well, that wasn't great commentary, or he should have been more prepared there, or how could he not know the name of that player, or how could he forget that, or, you know, he got stage fright at the moment that he could least afford it. But then I'd be consuming all kinds of media. I'd be reading the paper every morning on the bus. You know, I was 10 years old reading The Age. All my mates were talking about, you know, other things, and I just wanted to consume and learn and, I suppose, prepare myself for what I knew was, you know, on the cusp. So, but again, as you say, I probably wouldn't have put it in those words at the age of 10, but but innately I was definitely preparing myself.
I think this is so fascinating.
I think we've all got a similar story. I mean, really, with the things that drive us the most.
No, I grew up with ballet, classical music and opera, and cartoons and Humphrey B. Bear.
Yeah, but again, remember when I interviewed you for the Blueprint and I said, how do all of the jobs that you've had in your life, what have you drawn from all of those that now contribute to your current either career or state of being?
Yeah, rightio.
Your ballet and your Humphrey B. Bear and your everything, like, If you really drill down, and I'm going to get woo-woo with the queen of woo-woo, like if you really drill down on it, there are clues and hints and insights and value from every single experience of our life.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, so I think that, you know, the more I reflect on it, I like to reflect on things often because if things have seemed imperfect, I like to reflect on it and go, well, hold on a minute, it wasn't imperfect. I just don't get yet how it was perfect. So I just like to reflect on it to be able to put it into words so that I can understand why things have happened in my life, I suppose.
So do you think that willingness to reflect and find the perfection in the experience or the purpose in the experience at the time that you didn't see but later potentially became clear, do you think that takes a lot of the sting out of our experiences and it takes a lot of the questioning out of it when you can look back and go, well, hang on, at the time I know that I'm going to reflect on this, but right now this is occurring for me. I'm going to reflect on this in a year's time and I might see a purpose in it. So just go with the flow, be in whatever's there and wait. Just be patient and just wait.
Okay, well, let's hit it here then. For my 21st birthday, my mum, who I used to, cause I definitely don't anymore, but my mum for so long was one of those people that would talk a good talk but not walk a good walk.
Ah.
And she'd tell us all the wisdom of the world. But often I'd look at mum and go, well, hold on a minute, you tell me that, but you don't do that. And she would absorb, She doesn't do that anymore because I think she's an amazing, and maybe because I'm older and wiser, I can see the amazing woman that she is. But at the time, I didn't feel there was congruence there. But my mum was consuming Tony Robbins cassettes. Do you remember cassettes?
My goodness, I did a declutter not so long ago, and I've got tons of them.
All right, so my mum was doing the Tony Robbins 30-day personal power. It was in the car, and we'd listen to it, and I'd be, you know, 18 or 16 or whatever, going, "Mum, who is this? What is this?" And anyway, for my 21st birthday, my mum gave me Tony Robbins' Get the Edge personal power program for my 21st birthday. I think it was about $400. And we weren't going that well financially. My mum had been in court for a cafe purchase that had gone horribly wrong, the good old never do business with friends lesson. And we were struggling financially. And my mum gave me, you know, and as Tony Robbins would say, like, personal development is the best gift you can give people, particularly your staff, right? But my mum gave her son this personal empowerment program, and that sent me on a journey, I suppose, to go on this personal development path. And as a curious journalist, always wanting to consume more, I lapped it up and still continue to lap it up. But I think without, I suppose, that catalyst, I may not have the, I suppose, the inclination to reflect on the past so much, because the journalist in me wants to reflect, but maybe the human in me would be too scared to kind of piece together the puzzles, which don't feel like they fit all that well in my past. But
yeah,
having done so much personal development, literally spend houses on personal development, I relish the challenge of putting together those pieces which might hurt or which might not feel great, but, you know, if I don't find the perfection in them, then I'm just going to carry that baggage for as long as I choose to.
So tell us about your, because you got married relatively young, didn't you?
Well, I knew that when I met Sarah, I was 2005, late 2005. So, January 2005, we started dating, going out, asked her to be my girlfriend.
Oh, how and, cute.
We just celebrated 10 years since I asked her to be my girlfriend just the other week.
Oh, that's too sweet.
Yeah. So, look, I got married at 28, I think, but we were going out since I was 25. But
yeah,
we knew. We were one of those couples that moved relatively quickly. We knew what we were doing. We knew that it was, I suppose, going to happen. But that was probably another, I suppose, chapter in that, you know, I'm a Leo, Sarah's a Leo. Like, we're both selfish, for want of a better term. We both kind of are quite self-assured. I don't really, you know, I listen to others. Obviously, as a journalist, I love to listen to others, but I don't necessarily take on board what everyone tells me. I'm not impressionable to the point where I'll take everyone else's stuff on.
Yeah.
But Sarah's quite similar. And so obviously we clash, but we're also very aligned. We can obviously appreciate each other even more. So, so I think having that at the age of 25 felt having that life partner. Like, I knew when we met that it was all based on friendship. To give you a little bit of the story, when I met Sarah, it was through my best friend from uni is a girl called Alicia Loxley now. She presents the news on Channel 9 in Melbourne, but we went to uni together in Melbourne, and we were over in WA to meet a friend of Alicia's called Ali, who coincidentally was Sarah's best friend from chiropractic uni, and we were both over there on holiday at the same time. So I went over to Perth at the same time that Sarah went over to Perth. We met accidentally, coincidentally, and we became
no coincidences.
Exactly. I went over there, don't mean to put an explicit rating on this podcast, but I went over there to kiss as many girls and do as many other things with girls, that I could before I started at the footy show at Channel 9, because I knew that when I started Channel 9, I would be embarking on a very work hard, play hard, but the focus definitely on work hard. I knew that I wanted to have 12 months in live TV before I went overseas. I thought it would be great on the CV. I was desperate to go overseas and travel the world. And then I met Sarah. But when Sarah met me, she probably thought that I was a sleazebag, but I was going out to these pubs and clubs with three gorgeous girls, Sarah, Alicia, and Ali. And Karen and everyone listening, I did not kiss one girl because
oh my God.
My alibi is that every girl that saw me at a club or a pub saw me with three other gorgeous girls.
Absolutely.
And they would have assumed, naturally enough, that at least one of them was my girlfriend.
For sure.
So I was empty-handed by the end of the trip. But in the meantime, because I did have so much spare time up my sleeve, and Sarah actually she kind of had a guy back in Melbourne, but it was not a boyfriend. They'd kind of been together once. And anyway, we were developing a friendship. And when I mean a friendship, it was a true friendship. Like it was – We'd hang it on each other. We'd have play fights. It seemed very platonic, but I think people around us more than ourselves could actually sense that there were some sparks there. And so we had 2 weeks to really not even think about that we were actually making a go at each other. We were actually just genuine friends. And so by the end of 2 weeks, we'd actually realized that we really did have the hots for each other. And that was kind of how it all unfolded. And then I kissed Sarah in Busselton, WA, one night, and that was the beginning of the romance. Don't know how I got onto that, but there's the romance story.
It's beautiful.
I'm completely off topic, but
that was worth it. So you hooked up with Sarah. She's now a chiropractor.
Yeah, she'd been a chiro for a couple of years. I'd been a journo. We both got out of uni at the same time because she's a couple of years older than me. So she did her 5 years. I did my 3 years. We'd been out for 3 or 4 years each, both at similar stages of life, I suppose, both desperate to go overseas. We were determined, as Leos are, that we were going overseas independently of each other until about 6 months in, and our relationship was absolutely flying. And then we thought, hold on a minute, what are we talking about here? Let's go overseas together. Let's pool all of our money together. Let's go on this incredible journey. And we did, 2006. We left our jobs and went overseas, and best thing we ever did.
And so when you came back, did Sarah set up a practice?
She'd been an associate in country Victoria. But when we left our jobs, so I left Channel 9 after the Commonwealth Games in Melbourne. And then Sarah had left her associate work, and we went over to Ireland. And it was planning that I would do media work as a freelancer and Sarah would be an associate. But we knew pretty quickly I was getting the chiropractic bug. Like, I had no idea about chiropractic until I met Sarah. When I met Sarah, I was smoking, I was drinking. I thought I was healthy, but I wasn't. But I learned from Sarah a lot of principles about health, you know, a lot of what you talk about on Karen's Couch as well. And I'd learned a lot of principles through just being exposed to Sarah, what she'd gone through on a day-to-day basis. When I saw Sarah working with patients, I was just spellbound. Like, you know, the stories that I'd hear and the adjustments that I'd see unfold and the results people were getting. And I was interested in the business side of chiropractic as well. So we managed a practice for 12 months. And by the time I got back from overseas, I was not interested in going back to the media. As a short-term, you know, kind of money earner, I was happy to do some freelance work, but it was more about, we were determined to get married. We were engaged by the time we got back. We were determined to get married. We knew we were going to have kids. So we moved down to Inverloch, Victoria, down by the water where Sarah's parents lived as well, which we knew would be great for when we had kids. And we set up a chiropractic center. And I really wanted to start helping people, you know, set up myself as a health and lifestyle coach. And that's really what I thought that I would do.
Itself is quite fascinating, because that transition from, you know, having your whole life revolving around media and your whole, you know, right from childhood, but then all of a sudden you meet Sarah and bang, it's black versus white. You know, into the chiropractic movement, and journalism now is like a thing of the past. Obviously, it's skills that you've kept, but the concept of it being a career was just a thing of the past. How did everybody that you knew around you relate to such a dramatic change that you made?
I think a lot of them thought that I was, like, in the worst possible way, completely love-struck, to the point where I would totally shift my career. But I think the missing point of information here is that I'd done a lot of personal development. So by this stage, we'd done Tony Robbins' whole Mastery University. As a bookworm and as a journo, I'd been doing a lot of reading. And I think also in my time at Channel 9, you know, I was an associate producer, and the next step was going to be as an executive producer. And I saw the executive producer, who I loved to bits, but I saw that his lifestyle wasn't the lifestyle I wanted. You know, he was on good money, but he had two young kids and a wife, which it was a real struggle for him to have good quality time with them. I mean, we were doing big hours, you know, 12-hour days, sometimes longer. On show days, you know, we'd get in at 7 in the morning and sometimes not leave until 4 o'clock the next morning. I mean, that's a 21-hour day.
That's insane.
You know, and that's, I just, you know, as a 24 or however old I was, 25-year-old, it had no consequence. It was absolutely no worries. I knew that that was what I was paying up for. But as a, you know, as a young parent, you know, if I was driving in a Mercedes in a nice flash home but doing 21-hour days, like, I just didn't want to go there. And I saw where management was going in media, and it just bored me. Like, I didn't want that life. And, you know, I kind of lost the urge, I suppose, to go into commentary. I saw that lifestyle as well, and that didn't really do it for me. And so I think I'd grown out of that boyhood dream. Now I was an adult, I'd grown out of it.
And your priorities have changed because now it's not just about you. Now it's about Sarah, you, and family.
Yeah, so my vision, when I shifted careers, I knew that at some point I would combine my media skills with health and wellness. At the time, I had no idea how it was going to come about.
Yeah.
But I knew that that's where it was going. And, you know, now today, I mean, I can sit right now and go, I'm doing exactly what I knew I was going to do, but I had no idea at the time how I was going to do it. I just knew that it was going to be done, and I just had to have that faith.
So you worked with Sarah as a health coach, and no doubt that would have developed a lot of skills for you while you were developing your knowledge base and working with people. That would have, like, really prepared you quite well.
But this is the thing, though. I never got to the coaching because this was part of the metaphysical, universal, you know, roadblocks keeping me stronger. I was, again, a bit of an oldest child, so I often think that things are just going to happen without, you know, effort. Often I'm just very optimistic. So we set the business up so that I would be a coach and we'd have a chiropractic assistant and they would essentially do everything and Sarah would be the chiropractor. But 2 weeks into our business running, our chiropractic assistant got up and moved to Darwin, like literally letter on the desk. And at the time, it freaked us out. Sarah was in tears. And then it was like, well, Marcus is the CA. I was going to be the chiropractic assistant. And even though at the time I was resentful, I was like, this is getting in the way of me doing my life's purpose and how dare this happen. And I went into my pity party for a while there. But then I realized it was exactly what I needed because I needed to run that business. You know, any business owner knows that there's got to be a time at the beginning where you're in the business.
Yeah.
And I had to go into the business. Before I was going to train anyone, I had to be skilled at it myself. And so that was really important. And more importantly, as I think about it right now, for when we were going to have kids, you know, when we had kids, I just said to Sarah, babe, all you need to do when you go to work is to rock up and adjust patients. I don't want you thinking about any other process within the business. And thankfully, I had known and I'd worked on every other process within the business because of that experience of the CA leaving. But as a result, you know, I'd never really opened up that avenue to be a coach. I'd done it, you know, on the side with people that wanted it, but I'd never really promoted it. And it was only towards the end, you know, when we were preparing to sell the business and I had a bit more time up my sleeve, that when people came to me and said, you know, can you help me, I could actually devote the time to them and actually did it. But that was one of those lessons, I suppose, for actually making sure that I really, really, really wanted it. It wasn't handed to me on a silver spoon.
Yeah.
I actually got to the point where I knew that it was exactly what I wanted to do.
And so Sarah had kids. You and Sarah had kids, and that brought about another big change for you too, didn't it?
Yeah, in terms of realizing that, you know, Sarah realized particularly that she loved chiropractic, but she hated trying to balance out work, even though she loved her work, and being a parent. We were so deluded before we had kids. We said, all right, we'll get a locum in for 12 weeks, and when our child is 8 weeks of age, you know, Sarah will go back to work. And we thought that was perfectly fine. We thought that was absolutely normal. There'd be no worries there. And, you know, 8 weeks as a non-parent seems like so long.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking 56 days to get used to something. And 56 days for the baby to get used to us. And, You know, so Maya comes into the world 1 week overdue, so now it's 7 weeks of getting to know each other. By the time that 8th week turned around, we weren't really in a financial position to extend the locum. The locum was actually going overseas, so we couldn't keep her on any longer. Financially, it would have been risky to bring someone else on, so Sarah went back to work, and it was heartache. I could not stand watching her walk out the door crying on the first morning going to work. It just tore at the heartstrings, you know. And here I am, like you said, you know, provide a male brain going, what's going on? This just does not feel right at all. But for 2 or 3 years, I think, you know, that was our life. And but again, you know, even though it did not feel right, and sometimes things happen in our life that do not feel right, there's a greater purpose for all of it. And we got to a point where December 31, 2012, we said to each other, we're going to do one more winter in Inverloch, and then we're moving. And we knew we were going to move to somewhere between Byron Bay and Noosa. We knew we wanted a warmer climate. We knew we wanted to sell the business. We knew we wanted Sarah knew she wanted to be a mum. She knew that she was sick of balancing out work and mum. She knew that chiropractic would be there when the kids are older. She'd always be a chiro. She could always come back to it. She'll be even itchier to be a chiro in 5 years' time, having been out of it for so long.
Yeah.
But we were obviously, yeah, we were committed for that to occur. And so once we committed to it, and there's nothing like putting an ad in the, you know, industry mag saying that the business is for sale, that's when you know you're putting your life on the line.
Big decisions.
That's it. You know, we knew we'd be leaving family and we'd be moving interstate without any family around, but we knew that that was what our souls were both asking for. We wanted to move. We wanted to bring the kids up here. The weather, you know, the focus on health, the education up here, just the community, the bigger focus on community. I mean, where we were was great, but there were just a few missing ingredients which we realized if we never scratched the itch. And you meet so many people. When you make a move, you meet so many people that go, oh, yeah, we thought of moving once, but it never quite happened. Or, you know, just people, you can see you can see it in their eyes that they had an opportunity to do it, but they never quite did it. We knew that if we didn't scratch the itch, we'd regret it for the rest of our lives. So we fully committed to it. And it's amazing. When you fully commit to something, when you murder your options, so to speak, and you leave nothing on the table, things can happen quickly. So our practice sold, things got moving, and here we are now living up here in Byron Bay or just out of Byron Bay in Ocean Shores and loving life.
Living the dream. So now you've got Sarah at home, you've sold the business, you're living in Byron. So when you interviewed me, for your program called The Exceptional Life Blueprint.
That's it.
And listening to your story and all of the pivotal points where there were big changes and big decisions that you had to make, it's almost as if anybody knows about an exceptional life. Even your language, Marcus, as you've been telling me the story, it's like, we knew this, I knew that, I knew this, I knew that. You've had a sense of knowing that I think most people don't actually have. In fact, most people spend most of their time in places of uncertainty, which is where the whole self-help industry just really comes to its own, because it kind of gives people direction in terms of how to find certainty. And Tony Robbins is one of those guys who's just a legend at it.
Yeah.
So you've had so much knowing and so much certainty and clarity through all of the pivotal points in your life. Is that one of the things that inspired you to create this exceptional life blueprint, was, you know, to help people actually find certainty?
Yeah, well, I think for sure the big thing for me was my epiphany came, and as a vegan, I'm sure you love John Robbins because he is one of the greats in the vegan world. But the book that changed my life and really prompted the whole Exceptional Life Blueprint was Healthy at 100 by John Robbins. And it was the very introduction of that book. And I say this many times, but John Robbins was the heir to the throne of the Baskin-Robbins ice cream corporation, and he ostracized himself from the family and went on his own path. And he talks about, in the book that Yale did a study of people and asked them, you know, as you age, you become less useful, and as you age, you become less valuable. And do you agree with these statements? And, you know, essentially, the people that agree with this statement, the people that believe that as they age, they become less useful, die 7.5 years younger than people that believe that as they age, they become wiser, that they're more valuable, that they can connect their communities, they can pass on their wisdom, that they can, you know, that aging is a great process. And this was like, hold on a minute. For me, I was like, you know, the mass media totally spread the opposite message. Everyone I come into contact with totally believes that the rest of their life is not going to be the best of their life, that it actually is a steady decline rather than a steady incline in quality of life. And this for me was that was the catalyst for me wanting to put this program together. But again, that took me 5 years. It wasn't until we moved up here, a consulting gig. Once we sold the practice, I started consulting to chiros on how to communicate, you know, real health to their patients, because a lot of chiros and health practitioners in general are so, they're book smart, but in terms of communicating their knowledge to their patients, they've got really no idea, a lot of them. They're all just using big words and forgetting how to relate to the everyday man or woman. So
that's so true.
Yeah, so I was consulting with people how to do that, but that finished. And then I was like, you know what, with this time that I have, I'm going to knuckle down and put this program together. And so I put the program together in, I think it was 2 weeks. But I have a free 4-part video series. It goes for 90 minutes. I put that together in 2 weeks in terms of videoing it, editing it. And as a TV producer of the past, I'm a finicky editor, and I don't just like talk to a camera. I put in graphics and slides and other videos to make it interesting. It's a bad habit and a good habit, because it takes me forever to do, and I don't easily give the job to other people. I do it myself, so I can be spending a whole day, you know, editing a 30-minute video, and I come out to dinner with the kids and they're like, how are you, Daddy? I'm like, my brain is just fried, kids. Oh, you know, too much a perfection mindset in there. But I do, you know, I'm happily say I think the videos are very entertaining, but I do think that, you know, when the time was right, it just had to be done. You know, when you just put it off for far too long, and it's like, right, I'm going to put all this knowledge which is sitting in my head and it's coming out in dribs and drabs, whether it's in 100 Not Out or a Deep and Meaningful or a conversation or a blog or someone else interviews you and you give it. But I'd never put the framework together. I'd never put the 8 steps of this exceptional life blueprint into a framework, and I had to do it. It's kind of like, you know, it's part of my legacy. My kids can live it, you know, my family can live it, people that learn it can live it, and they can share it with their kids. And I just had to do it, or else I'd go nuts keeping it inside me any longer.
It's kind of like your journalism. You just had to do it.
And it's, oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And, you know, with your creating of your video and your content and stuff, a lot of people would outsource that. But it's like when you were working in chiropractic as a CA there, as a chiropractic assistant, you actually have to be in the business. There's a time when you actually have to do that. There's a time when it comes to outsource it. But, you know, my sister gave me some amazing advice in business. She said, because when I first started in business, I really wanted to put on telemarketers and salespeople. And she said to me, no. She said, no. She said, you have to do it yourself. She said, the day will come when you can outsource it. But she said, if you outsource it without knowing how to do it, you can't measure and manage it. You can't make sure that it fits your style. You can't make sure that it's right. She said, you've got to perfect it first before you give it to somebody else, so that then you know that what they're doing is what you really want. And you don't know what you don't know until you're actually in the game and doing it.
Yeah, and I think just as you're saying this, I'm thinking of Steve Jobs, who I read his biography recently, and exactly the same. He was almost a control freak. Well, not almost, was a control freak. But I think because when you know so much, you do have a real focus on quality. But you asked before, because I tend to go off topic, you asked about doubt and certainty and, you know, where all of that comes from. But I'd love your thoughts on this, Karen, but everyone's scared. It's like insecurities. Everyone is insecure. Everyone is scared. Everyone has fears. It's just what you choose to do with it. Like, my whole view is, it's so cliche, but I'd rather feel the fear and do it anyway. And I'm not going to come up with a different line for it. Straight out of Susan Jeffers and her book, it's just, okay, if you're not scared, you're not trying hard enough, or you're not exposing yourself enough to your greatness. I don't know anyone that's done anything great that wasn't scared. They just had to do it anyway.
And I think that a lot of people do feel the fear, and it stops them. And then they feel resentment, and then they feel frustration. And, you know, sometimes that's projected outwards, but for the most part it's inwards, and it becomes, you know, self-deprecation, and becomes more the whole, I'm not good enough, I'm not good enough, I'm not good enough, therefore yep. I'll never get that. And then that, oh, I'm not good enough, grabs them by the throat and rules their life.
Yep.
And I think that's one of the things that I think that the Exceptional Life Blueprint kind of uncovers for people, is showing them the possibility of what they can become if they make the choice to live an exceptional life.
And my view is, as selfish as it sounds, who are you not to give your gifts and do what you want to do? Like, the biggest regret of any human being, and this was written by Bronnie Ware in her great book, The Top 5 Regrets of the Dying, the biggest regret we have is that we didn't live our life according to our own expectations and values, except we subordinated our lives to the expectations of others and didn't live our life on our own terms. Who are you to live your life on someone else's terms? That just sucks. That's just not what you were put on this earth to do. So even though it hurts, even though you're scared, it's no one else's business to live your life than yours. So really, again, I don't mean to sound simplistic about it, but who cares what anyone else thinks?
It's true. It's true. So where can people get their hands on the Exceptional Life Blueprint so that they can start to get the same kind of mindset?
Yeah, sure. So the videos are at exceptionallifeblueprint.com.au. Just go there. All you have to do is put in your email address so I can send you all of the other videos, and you get that 4-video series. I think it's about 90 minutes. It might even be a bit more. So there's a bit of consuming to be done, but there's also worksheets there. There's life purpose planners and all kinds of tools and resources there just to bring more clarity to life, because again, I know it's used a lot, but clarity is definitely power. And particularly, you know, from a journalistic background, which you and I both have, the whole reason media is here is to bring clarity to events that are going on in our lives. We might have a 5-set tennis match, which might go for 4 hours, but we bring clarity to it by doing a 1-minute piece on it. That gives you a snapshot of actually what happened. And we need to condense, you know, our thoughts, which are a million miles a second. We need to condense our thoughts and our lives, you know, into a clear, I suppose, plan so that we can actually live our exceptional life. Otherwise, if we have this overwhelm and this, I suppose, this constant array of thoughts, we just live in overwhelm, we live in complexity, and we just never get around to living our best life.
I think that's so profound. Living in complexity really robs a person of experiencing what life's really all about. And we do. We overcomplicate absolutely everything. And yep. I think our emotions play a big part of that, but obviously our emotions are a product of our thoughts. So it's kind of, you know, you've really got to, and I've said this on the last couple of podcasts, you've got to tune in rather than tuning out to become aware of what's really going on, so that then you can, you know, you can start to look at what needs to be simplified rather yeah. than being completely unaware and oblivious and just, you know, having life live through you randomly. I think that there's a real missing link in terms of participating.
That's it. Yeah. Spot on.
Yeah. Thank you, my friend. This has been a top conversation.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for going down the rabbit hole with me. I've enjoyed it immensely.
I love a rabbit hole. Love yes. a good rabbit hole. So thank you. This has been really cool. And everybody, make sure that you jump along to the exceptionallifeblueprint.com.au. I'm going to sign up for that now myself, although I've already got it, haven't I, Marcus?
Yeah, you've got the videos.
I've got them all. I'm going to go back through them again. Yeah,
I'll send you the links just in case you've lost them.
Well, do you know, I've lost all my emails, so it would actually be really helpful if you would. That would be really good.
Consider it done.
Yeah, beauty. So it's the exceptionallifeblueprint.com.au. Marcus, thanks for being on the show. You're an absolute treasure.
Thank you, Karen. Continue spreading your word. You're doing an amazing job, and I consider myself very fortunate to be a part of your life.
Oh, all love back to you, my friend.
Thanks, so gorgeous.
For everybody listening to the show, make sure that you go to exceptionallifeblueprint.com.au. I'm also going to put the link underneath the show. So if you forget or you're driving and you can't write that down, just whip on over to karenscouch.com and you will see that the link to the Exceptional Life Blueprint will actually be there for you. And it'll also be on our Facebook page at allthews.facebook.com/Karen's Couch. So go ahead and leave us any questions for Marcus and I'll make sure that he gets them. And you can also leave any comments or particular topics that you potentially want to explore about your life. And if you're looking for an exceptional life, what are you looking for? And what's currently missing for you right now? make sure that you post that on our Facebook page, because I think it's time to open up the conversation around that. So thanks for tuning in. Thanks for joining us once again on Karen's Couch. Join us here next week, same time, same station, where we bring the truth to your unanswered questions. What a treat hanging out with you once again. All my love coming your way down the airways. We'll see you here next week. Bye for now.
This has been a production of TheWellnessCouch.com. Check us out on Facebook and join in the conversation on Facebook.com/TheWellnessCouch. Subscribe to each show on iTunes and check us out on Twitter. The Wellness Couch, streaming wellness into your lives.
Whilst the Wellness Couch presenter endeavor to provide accurate and helpful information to their listeners, these podcasts cannot take into account individual circumstances and are not intended to be a substitute for health and medical advice from a qualified health professional. You should always seek the advice of a qualified health professional before acting on any of the information provided by any of the Wellness Couch podcasts.